Part 2. Reshaping of the Guarded Domains. Consolidation of the Qajar dynasty set the stage for Iran's gradual transformation through the long 19th century. New strategic and economic realities, particularly the rise of two European empires on the northern and southern frontiers, turned Iran into a buffer state, a mixed blessing with important consequences. Despite the loss of territory and depleted economic resources, Qajar Iran preserved its political sovereignty and reinvented the Persian institution of kingship. Stronger bonds with the urban elite included the revived clerical establishment, sustained the state's otherwise fragile sway over the tribal periphery, and brought about a period of recovery. The growing volume of foreign imports from industrialized Europe and the export of cash crops, such as tobacco and opium, tilted the economic balance in favor of big merchants, large landowners, and European firms. Less privileged sectors of society, such as guilds, retailers, and peasants, bore the brunt of the changing economy. Chronic visitations of famine and pandemics worsened their lot. Popular grievances against the Qajar state and the Shi'i clerical establishment in the middle decade of the century triggered the millennial Babi movement, a pivotal event in the anti-Sharia trends in the Iranian milieu. The movement, charged with Shi'i messianic aspirations, gave voice to anti-clerical and socio-economic grievances. Despite its military defeat, the clandestine Babi loyalties remained the vehicle of popular dissent throughout the Qajar period. By contrast, the discourse of reform that was articulated by modernist intellectuals enjoyed a far smaller audience. In the second half of the 19th century, selective projects of modernization, particularly the creation of a telegraphic network and the introduction of modern banking, anticipated the rise of a national market. Though primarily beneficial to foreign interests, these networks allowed the Qajar state to further centralize and more effectively govern the provinces. By the close of the 19th century, modern communications also allowed for voices of protest to be widely heard during the tobacco protest. By the turn of the 20th century, mass protests that came to shape the constitutional revolution fused older demands for social justice and national salvation with modern notions of the constitution, rule of law, popular representation, material development, and awareness of modern nationalism. The revolution brought together for the first time dissident intellectual, merchants, members of the high-ranking clergy, and reformist elements within the nobility. Against many domestic and foreign odds, the constitutional revolution proved a transformative experience with multiple facets. Beyond its socio-political discourse, the revolution peaked a period of rich cultural and artistic fluorescence, and the Qajar period found its distinct voice in poetry, painting, calligraphy, book production, architecture, music, photography, journalism, and performing arts. In what might be called a process of Persianization, aspects of Western art and literature were incorporated with an air of cultural confidence. 4. The Making of the Qajar Era, 1797 to 1852. During the first half of the 19th century, Qajar Iran partially recovered from the material losses of the previous decades. The slowing of nomadic incursions from the periphery allowed a degree of stability, and the Persian model of government they had adopted brought a semblance of control over most of Iran proper. Agriculture recuperated and regional and international trade revitalized. Urban populations began to grow, and the hinterlands were recouped. Yet, by the end of Fath Ali Shah's reign, 1798 to 1834, Iran's population still barely exceeded 4 million. Facing European powers on its borders, both Russia and Britain, Qajar Iran appeared unprepared. It began to sense the magnitude of challenges to its empire in war and diplomacy, while still recovering from ravages of the past. European powers defeated Iran in war, seized portions of its prized territory, put pressure on the state through diplomacy and trade, and at times even threatened its very sovereignty. At the outset of the 19th century, the east-west two-frontier Iran of the Safavid and post-Safavid eras was substantially changed to a new north-south two-frontier reality. Qajar Iran's self-image as an empire at the centre of its own universe also changed into one of a vulnerable nation in the throes of Christian powers. Yet, despite its inherent disadvantages, Qajar Iran escaped domination by colonial powers in part because of the dictates of its geography, but also because of a degree of resistance displayed by the Qajar state and its subjects. Iran endured within its shrunken borders, while many countries in the non-Western world gradually succumbed to colonial rule. The Iranian state and society also began to adopt, in their own terms, selective aspects of Europe's material and intellectual cultures. The mixed experience of contention and adoption helped shape Iran's perceptions of modernity throughout the Qajar period. The early Qajar period also witnessed the emergence of a potent Shi'i clerical establishment. It was conservative in outlook and at times defiant toward the state, suspicious of its modernizing measures. To maintain its network of privileges and social influence, the jurist establishment of the Usuli school articulated a legal theory that promoted believers' close following, taglid, of the mujtahids in all intricate matters of religious life. Grounded in Safavid learning, the Usuli school regulated not only the believer's behavior, but also society's moral and legal conduct through an elaborate set of rules and rituals. The Qajar state's desire to preserve the status quo helped sustain the Shi'i jurists as a formidable force. Yet the symbiosis of the state and the ulama establishment acted as a barrier against innovative thinking and wider cultural adaptation. These themes have provoked contesting viewpoints about the Qajar period. Much historiography of the 20th century, influenced by condescending European attitude, viewed the Qajar period as an age of defeat and decadence. Such an outlook belittles, if not discredits, the important achievements of the Qajar period, not only its survival as a sovereign state, but also its cultural agility. The early 19th century witnessed a literary and artistic revival of lasting influence. Shi'i legal scholarship scored great gains. Despite their scholastic rigidity, Shi'i jurists of the period articulated a complex discourse of methodology of law, better known as the Principles of Jurisprudence, Usul al-Fiqh, after which the Usuli school is named. The revival of the Aristotelian philosophy of the school of Isfahan also encouraged new approaches and produced new commentaries. The revival of the Shi'i Sufi orders, a legacy of the Zand period, counterbalanced the ulama in the cities at all levels and generated new theosophical and mystical works. The Qajar era also witnessed the rise of new socio-religious movements that espoused indigenous reforms embedded in Perso-Shi'i environment rather than being wholesale imports from the outside. The Babi movement was the culmination of a process of dissent within Shi'ism, with a message of religious and social renewal rooted in Iran's messianic experiences of the past. Later in the century, reformists of all shades, freethinkers, revolutionaries, state officials, and dissidents, addressed moral and material decline, critiqued the social and cultural norms of their time, and offered either indigenous or Western-inspired syntheses. Qajar Iran displayed remarkable artistic and literary vitality in painting, calligraphy, bookmaking, music, and architecture, as well as in poetry and prose. Traditional industries and crafts, especially textiles, reached a new level of refinement, and Western techniques and technologies, including the telegraph, photography, and book printing, gained popularity. These landmarks stand in contrast to the backdrop of depravity and misfortune with which the Qajar era has often been associated. Reclaiming imperial authority. Even before encountering the European powers on his doorsteps, Fath Ali Shah had to quell half a dozen rebellions throughout Iran, first in Azerbaijan and Isfahan, where he faced a pro-Zand resurgence, and later in Luristan, Khorasan, Yazd, and the Caucasus, where a variety of tribal chiefs shunned the notion of loyalty to the Qajars. Even though Aga Muhammad Khan believed that he had raised a royal palace and cemented it with blood, the blood of actual and potential contenders to the Qajar throne, there were still claims to the Qajar crown, and not just allegorical ones. Shadr Khan Shugah, the ambitious Kurdish chief in Agha Muhammad Khan's army, and possibly the brains behind his assassination, had snatched away the newly constructed Kayanid crown and the royal jewels, and marched back to his tribal estate in northern Azerbaijan. In 1798, Fath Ali Shah had to wage a war to recover Azerbaijan and regain his symbols of royal power, which he could do only piecemeal. The rebellion of the Shugah chief, more importantly, demonstrated a palpable desire by the Kurdish tribes to rule over a region stretching from Sulaymaniyah, in today's Iraqi Kurdistan, to the southern Caspian coasts and on to northern Khorasan. Sadegh's defeat and destruction, by the Shah's order his prison cell was bricked up and he was left to die, put an end to the Kurdish defiance. By 1800, the Qajars took the last stronghold of the Afsharids in Khorasan after several expensive campaigns. The Qajar Shah, nevertheless, was mindful of his Qajar chiefs and their whimsical loyalty. Some of them covertly backed the Shah's younger brother in his bid for the Qajar throne. With great difficulty, Fath Ali Shah eventually succeeded in removing his adventurous brother, but not before destroying his influential Grand Vizier, Haji Ibrahim Kalantar, who was accused of treason, presumably for colluding with the Shah's rebellious brother. The chief minister was put to death along with most members of his extended family. His execution was the first of a number of executions of viziers in the Qajar era, as a sign of the monarch's consolidation of personal power. The practice once more displayed the fundamental vulnerability of the Divan with respect to the Shah's authoritarian rule. The struggle between the minister and the monarch for control of the government hindered the Divan's autonomy and its greater institutionalization. Haji Ibrahim has often been harshly judged by posterity, seldom credited for his motivations to cure Iran of tribalism and civil war. The British representative of the East India Company, Captain John Malcolm, who met Haji Ibrahim shortly before the Grand Vizier's downfall, advised him to respond with a better temper to the Shah's occasional fit of ill humour and violence. In response, the Vizier restated his yearning for a united country under a strong government. "I could easily save myself, but Persia again be plunged in warfare. My objective has been to give my country one king. I cared not whether he was a Zand or a Qajar, so that there was an end of internal destruction. I have seen enough of these scenes of blood. I will be concerned in no more of them." After Haji Ibrahim, some members of the Fars bureaucratic faction who were suspected of collaborating with the fallen minister returned to royal favour and gained high office within the Divan's multi-regional structure. They were the counterforce to the northern party, the officials who were from Mazandaran, especially the Nur region, who early under Agha Muhammad Khan came to the service of the Qajar. The influence of both factions was curtailed by a third party from the central provinces, mostly from Farahan and its vicinity, a region of high literacy with a culture of statecraft. Even more than the southern and the northern parties, the Farahan faction secured its own continuity in the state administration. Having earlier served under the late Safavids and the Zands, Farahan produced capable statesmen, including the Qaim Makam family and their client Mirza Taghi Khan Amir Kabir. The Qajar rulers played off the competing factions and manipulated rivalries to their own advantage. Subduing provincial revolts, the Qajar Khans and Divan went hand in hand with a new spirit of grandiosity in Fath Ali Shah's court. Elaborate protocol, ceremony-laden public and private audiences, salam, an ostentatious show of wealth, and large numbers of court attendants, pageboys, servants, guards, musicians, and dancers, as well as ornate dresses, sumptuous dishes, a lavish lifestyle, numerous royal palaces, gardens, hunting grounds, and royal cavalcades, all became symbols of Qajar power. A large number of life-size portrayals of female musicians, singers, and dancers, no doubt many of whom were employed in the sprawling courts of Fath Ali Shah and his sons, exhibited an Epicurean culture of leisure and revelry. Fath Ali Shah was as much the center of this glittering universe as his uncle Agha Muhammad Khan had been the master of the military camp, of long horse rides, incessant campaigning, and military discipline. Even Fat Ali Shah's personal appearance epitomized this stark contrast. Unlike Agha Muhammad Khan's slight physique and wrinkled, beardless face, Fat Ali's long, black, bushy beard and his attractive, though rather effeminate countenance was meant to announce to all his majestic dignity and sexual potency. In contrast to the rough-and-ready tent-dwelling warrior Khans, Fat Ali was a calm and colourful king of kings, well-established in the secure and opulent surrounding of the royal palaces. This surely was the image the court painters of the period were commissioned to present in their numerous life-size portrayals of the Shah. He often was shown sitting on his new sun throne, Takht-e-Khurshid, later known as the Peacock Throne, or Takht-e-Tavus, wearing his reconstructed Kayanid crown, which was distinct from Agha Muhammad Khan's. The Shah dressed in the most exquisite silk robes, wore the legendary armlets with the Darya-e-Nur and Taj Mah encrusted on two armlets, and was surrounded by the implements of his sovereignty, sword, shield, mace, and royal sceptre. All these were meant to convey symbolically a sense of continuity and control, particularly to the neighbouring European empires. The new Kayanid crown, which replaced the turban-like cap of the Zand period, advertised the recapture of the royal jewels, spectacular trophies bundled together in a cylindrical structure symbolic of the political power gathered in the office of the King of Kings. The Qajar kingship drew attention to the memory of the ancient Iranian past, as narrated in the Shahnameh, and visible in the rock reliefs and ancient ruins of the Achaemenid and Sasanian periods. Fat Ali Shah, who was brought up in the Zand court and served as governor of Fars under his uncle, assimilated these imperial symbols to underscore centralization of his rule and to forge an alternative source of legitimacy. These perceptions of Iranian kingship were revived and maintained alongside Timurid ties to a tribal past, which the Qajars had a difficult time abandoning entirely. These perceived sources of authority, of course, went hand in hand with a Qajar claim to temporal leadership of the Shi'i community and defense of Shi'i Islam, a Safavid legacy. It can be argued that the Qajars' multiple layers of political authority tied the image of the King of Kings more closely to Iran. The royal image that was put on display, through the media of stone sculptures in rock reliefs, large-scale paintings, epic poetry, and dynastic histories, was meant to be seen by both the elite and the general public, and by the Europeans. As early as the 1810s, the Qajar rock reliefs and other pictorial presentations were being carved in the Achaemenid and Sasanian styles, some adjacent to ancient sites. Even acts of archaeological vandalism, such as the rock relief commissioned by one of the Shah's sons, Muhammad Ali Mirza Dolat Shah, carved over a corner of the famous 7th-century Sasanian relief in Tagheer-Bastan in Kermanshah province, were meant to remind viewers of the return of ancient royal splendour. Another rock relief that depicted a courtly scene near the ancient ruins of Rai, south of Tehran, was a clear breach of the general Islamic ban on depicting the human image. Efforts to demonstrate historical continuity are also evident in the literature of the period, notably in the revival of the classical Khorasan school of epic poetry. A clear break from Safavid metaphorical formalism, such a conscious return to the style of the classical masters of the 10th and 11th centuries, is well evident in the Shahanshah Nameh, Book of the King of Kings, by the poet Fat Ali Khan Sabah. Like many figures in the literary Royal Society, Anjaman-e Khagan, patronized by the Shah, Sabah came from the Zand cultural milieu. Modeled on Ferdowsi's Shahnameh, Sabah's long poem recounted Fat Ali Shah's epic deeds. With generous poetic license, it imagined the exploits of the Qajar ruler in battle and on the hunting grounds. The triumphant spirit in the poem nevertheless militated against the reality of heavy setbacks in the war with Russia. Royal progeny and the dilemma of succession. To further strengthen royal authority, Fat Ali Shah also embarked on a long-term policy of ridding the throne of the troublesome Qajar chiefs, largely by installing in their place members of his own immediate family, especially a new generation of royal princes who soon were to come of age. In an incredible feat of reproduction, more than 100 sons and daughters were born to the Shah in less than 50 years, the outcome of maintaining a large harem with hundreds of wives and concubines. Fateh Ali's conscious effort to compensate for the childlessness of his castrated uncle has been the subject of much criticism and ridicule by later observers. Though certainly he was not free from sensual indulgence and narcissistic extravagance, as evident from the reports of the period, having a large harem and many children was not without a political rationale. The senior princes of the royal family liberated the Shah from the yoke of the rancorous Qajar Khans and provided him with more reliable tools of governance. Political marriages, whether his own or those of his sons and daughters, fostered family ties with Khans of Qajar and other tribes, military officers, and urban dignitaries. Multitudes of royal offspring, moreover, were progeny of captive Zand, Afshar, Kurd, and Lur wives. Others were born to Georgian and Armenian women captured during earlier campaigns in the Caucasus, or to Jewish young women taken by consent or by force from communities throughout Iran. The Shah's sons also created their own large households in the image of their father. By the 1860s, some three decades after Fateh Ali's death, the highly procreative Qajar princely class numbered about 10,000. In reclaiming imperial authority, Fateh Ali Shah introduced a semi-autonomous system of princely governments under the umbrella of the central state, a legacy of the Safavid era and before that the Seljuk period. This feature gave new meaning to the official title of the country as the guarded domain of Iran. Senior princes mostly served as provincial governors in Tabriz, Shiraz, Kermanshah, Isfahan, and Mashhad, or as high officials in the expanding Qajar court and military. Younger princes were sent to smaller governments. Creating regional governments was a realistic solution to the center-periphery tension embedded in the geopolitical setup of Qajar Iran. There was a limited degree of interference from the capital, but the prince governors often acquiesced to the Shah's oversight. They were accompanied by their tutors, often high-ranking members of the Qajar nobility, and by senior bureaucrats who served as acting governors. Both officers reported directly to Tehran. Abbas Mirza, 1789-1833, the crown prince and most celebrated of the Shah's sons, was sent off to Tabriz in 1799 with the title of viceroy, Naeba Sultane, the highest of the princely ranks. His minister, Mirza Isa, Mirza Bozarg, Gayem Magam, was a former Zand official of the Farahani faction and one of the most capable statesmen of the early Qajar period. Abbas Mirza came to Tabriz at a time when the city was recovering its position as a gateway to the Caucasus and beyond. It also became the centre for a flourishing trade with Europe through the Ottoman Black Sea port of Trabzon, and it maintained its overall prominence for the rest of the century as the most prosperous and most populated city in the realm. It was through Tabriz in the first quarter of the century that the earliest manifestations of modern European military arrived. Regimentation, new weaponry, drill officers, uniforms, and military education. Also through Azerbaijan came European and American missionaries, the press and publications, the earliest foreign newspapers, luxury goods, machine-manufactured fabrics, gadgets of all sorts, and the much-admired Sheffield penknives. The Tabriz administration was given significant latitude by the central government to conduct diplomacy and trade, and, if necessary, war in the northwest. Abbas Mirza's diplomatic engagements with both Russia and Britain gave Qajar Iran its first taste of European empires. During the two rounds of war with Russia, Tabriz served as the hub of diplomacy and the headquarters for conducting military operations. As the abode of sovereignty, Dar al-Sultaneh, the official title of the city, Tabriz held control over its own army, finances, and regional affairs. Abbas Mirza himself not only held the title of viceroy, but also was frequently addressed by the title of Shah, in contrast to Fateh Ali Shah's title, Shahanshah. Only toward the end of his father's reign was Abbas Mirza officially recognized as crown prince, Veliahda, literally the guardian of the royal covenant. Tehran's official name, Dar al-Khilafa, the abode of the caliphate, an odd title for a Shi'i capital, which possibly claimed in competition with Istanbul as the capital of the Ottoman caliphate, pointed to the multipolar nature of Qajar sovereignty. The eastern Safavid capital, Herat, which also was referred to as Dar al-Sultaneh, never acquired by the Qajars, despite several attempts. Azerbaijan's regional autonomy was offset by at least three other powerful princely seats in the south, the west, and the east, and by several less prominent seats in Kerman, Isfahan, and Kurdistan. After ousting his rebellious brother, Fateh Ali Shah assigned Fars and the Persian Gulf provinces to another of his senior sons, Hossein Ali Mirza, the same age as Abbas Mirza, but of a non-Qajar mother, his official title being Farman Farma, literally enforcer of royal decrees. Hossein Ali Mirza maintained regional autonomy in the south, and, as did Abbas Mirza, he survived in his post for more than three decades. Similarly, a vast domain in western Iran was assigned to the Shah's oldest son, Muhammad Ali Mirza, a bold and ambitious prince born to a Georgian mother whose title, Dolat Shah, literally the Shah's political fortune, implied that he too was Shah of his own domain. He remained in office until his death in 1821. Long-term tenure entrenched the princes in their provinces and fostered the all-too-familiar rivalry among the Shah's sons. Yet the balancing act in the Qajar princely system proved successful insofar as it recognized the reality of Iran's regional diversity and helped the country's economic recovery. The manner of succession, however, despite efforts to regulate it, remained a contentious issue in early Qajar politics, and it had domestic and foreign implications. Competition for the succession, which had not been fully decided, began very early. To prove their worth, the princes were encouraged not only to rebuild the economy and secure calm in their domains, but also to resume territorial expansion along Iran's frontiers. The Shah gave his implicit consent for such campaigns, often carried out to deflect attention from internal strife. He even played a part in fostering some fraternal rivalry. Abbas Mirza's investiture as heir apparent in 1828 was not fully supported by all his ambitious brothers. Later, from the 1830s on, the struggle for succession further entangled the Qajar throne in a web of European imperial politics. Welcoming the English. The domestic equilibrium that was achieved under Fateh Ali Shah was put to the test of European power politics from the very beginning of the 19th century. This was a mixed blessing for Iran, which had emerged from its 18th century isolation only to encounter Europe at the outset of Napoleonic era. On the one hand, the presence of European powers helped stabilize the Iranian frontiers and consolidate the Qajar state. On the other hand, European strategic, territorial, and commercial ambitions turned Iran into an arena of intense and at times highly disruptive rivalries. Europe's territorial gains and diplomatic pressures came with interventions in Iran's domestic affairs, and with a race to acquire commercial and other advantages, capitulatory rights, and later economic concessions. Europe's condescending attitude, gradually setting in as Iran's weaknesses on the battlefield became more apparent, served as a cultural backdrop. In the north, Iran was taken by surprise at the territorial ambitions of its northern neighbour, and soon bore the brunt of Russian expansion in the Caucasus and then Central Asia. To Iran's south and southeast, somewhat more distant but still threatening, was the expanding British India, with its concerns for the security of its most precious colonial possession. Concern with Afghan principalities in the northwest, and soon after fear of French and then Russian advances toward the Persian Gulf and the Indian subcontinent, largely determined the British strategy toward Qajar Iran. Russia and Britain's mutual fears and suspicion of each other in effect sealed the fate of Iran's geopolitics for the entire Qajar period. Increasingly, Iran became a buffer between two ambitious empires, neither of which was particularly mindful of its wishes or its plight. The arrival in 1800 of the East India Company's mission, headed by Captain John Malcolm, opened a new chapter in Anglo-Iranian relations. Perhaps the most influential envoy of the Fat Ali Shah period, Malcolm sought an alliance to persuade Iran to move against Zaman Shah, the Afghan ruler of Kabul, who posed a threat to Punjab, then in the midst of a complex power struggle. He also announced the East India Company's victory in 1799 over Tipu Sultan, the ruler of Mysore. Shortly before Malcolm, Tipu Sultan had sent a mission to the Persian court proposing a grand anti-British alliance to Fat Ali Shah, as well as to Zaman Shah in Kabul, and the Sultan of Muscat. Malcolm, who played a pivotal role in the conquest of Mysore and later as the private secretary of Marquess Wellesley, the chief architect of British colonial hegemony, viewed Iran as an important party to the security of Hindustan, a policy that remained in effect for the entire Qajar period. After the lapse of a century, the Qajar government welcomed diplomatic and commercial relations with Britain. Yet, before granting Malcolm and his retinue a royal audience, the state officials were anxious to learn more about English advances in India. As early as the victory over the French at the Battle of Pondicherry in 1759, and later the English advances in Bengal in the final decades of the 18th century, the Zands, and later the Qajars, viewed British colonial successes with a mix of awe and anxiety. The arrival of a sizable English mission at the Qajar court therefore had symbolic implications insofar as it allowed the Qajars to register equality with the British crown. The state officials thus were careful to negotiate with Malcolm the details of court etiquette. English officers' caps and boots particularly became a major issue. The court agreed that caps could be removed, as it was the British custom, and the boots to be wrapped in makeshift covers, to observe Persian custom of taking off shoes in interior spaces. Permission to sit in the presence of the Shah, however, was denied. The audience with Fat Ali Shah went amicably. There was every reason for each side to impress the other with displays of wealth and might, but also of knowledge. Malcolm amused the Shah and amazed his court officials with his knowledge of the Qajar tribe and its history. Fat Ali Shah impressed Malcolm, and later other English envoys, with his awareness not only of the East India Company's advances in India, but also of the loss of the American colonies and the rise of a modern republic in the New World. Other examples of cultural exchanges highlighted the contrasting goals that each hoped to achieve. Offering and receiving of gifts was but one symbolic language employed in this new diplomacy. Malcolm's presence of jewels and luxury goods for the Shah and his ministers and officials, which had cost the East India Company a small fortune, were meant to impress the Persian court, purchase their favour, and persuade the Shah to act against the Afghan threat, which he eventually did. The English had long been accustomed to offering gifts to Indian princely states in exchange for colonial treaties. But the Shah preferred to receive the presents and view the company's overtures in a different light. He did not see the gifts as an incentive to facilitate his cooperation. Rather, he received the gifts as a tribute brought to his throne as proof of his imperial might. The pomp and circumstance of Fat Ali Shah's court, his opulence and elaborate protocol, may well be viewed as a necessary display of political power to impress his domestic and neighbouring contenders, having been aware of the English naval might and commercial power. It perhaps took two decades before the Qajar ruler and his government fully absorbed the complexity of European colonial enterprise and what it meant for Iran. At the outset of the Russo-Persian conflict in 1800, the same year as Malcolm's arrival in Tehran, over the vassalage of Georgia, it would have been highly impolitic of the Shah to turn down Malcolm's offer of friendship and the prospect of concluding a treaty of cooperation and commerce, one that took 13 more years to be ratified in 1814 at the close of the Napoleonic Wars. In contrast to the Russians, whom the Qajars considered as brute aggressors, the English were perceived as shrewd, disciplined, and foresighted. They were admired for their negotiating skills, stratagems, and measured use of military force. Malcolm epitomised the enterprising spirit of the British colonial expansion in its most flourishing era. A colonial strategist, soldier, diplomat, and scholar, He defined British policy toward Iran and promulgated the British attitude toward Iranians. His History of Persia, from the most early period to the present time, first published in 1815, featured Iran as a nation with geopolitical integrity and historical continuity stretching back to ancient times, a nation whose best days, in his portrayal, had already passed. Based on European and Persian sources, in every respect his history displayed the spirit of the English Orientalist enterprise, curious and disciplined, and with a desire to collect, systematize, represent, and ultimately dominate. He portrayed a Persian state that was alert and even awe-inspiring, and a society that was fascinating and complex. Yet he pointed to decadence and despotism everywhere. Malcolm's was among a host of early 19th century European accounts published on Iran as the country and new state became a focus of European strategic interests. Travelogues, histories, geographical descriptions, and archaeological discoveries, many of them illustrated, became a source of fascination for European readers. These accounts, not as extensive as the literature produced on Hindustan or Egypt, nevertheless were influential in shaping perceptions of Iran. Like other travel literature of the colonial period, they were often taken by readers as reassuring evidence of European, and especially British, material and cultural superiority. By contrast, Persian knowledge of Europe and colonial India remained scant and anecdotal. By the time Malcolm's mission arrived, the Qajar state knew little about modern Europe and its geography, history, society, and politics, and even less about the New World. A few Persian accounts of contemporary Europe had been compiled, mostly by members of the Persian secretarial class residing in Hindustan and in contact with the British colonizers. They translated brief passages from European almanacs about the history and geography of Europe and the New World. One such example, Tafat al-Alam, Gift of the World, by Mir Abdul Latif Shushtari, with an addendum completed in 1805. In addition to praiseful review of Western scientific innovations and contempt for such upheavals as the French Revolution, offered a view on the systematic pathology of British colonial expansion. Annexing Indian princely states, he observed, invariably began with early trade relations and the signing of treaties of friendship, then continued in the next stage with the offer of military assistance and political advice to what Shushtari viewed as lethargic and hedonistic rulers, eventually leading to full takeover by means of persuasion or coercion. Shushtari ended his account with a hopeful note, wishing for the Iranian state to not go down the Indian path, to remain alert and withstand the imminent threats to its sovereignty through insight and good government. His word of caution, however, was heard by his compatriots only years later, when Tafat al-Alam was finally published in 1847 and then only in Hyderabad. By then, Iran has already lost to Russia its prized possessions in the north. Russian menace and European rivalries. For Qajar Iran, the strategic value of an alliance with England was primarily the ability to withstand the Russian threat. By 1801, Tsar Alexander I, reigned 1801 to 1825, reaffirmed his predecessor's seizure of Georgia over the objection of a few of his advisers. What made the southern drive appealing to the Tsars was in part a desire to place Russia on an equal footing with other European powers in the race for colonial gains. Alexander and his like-minded advocates of Russian expansion relied on sympathizers in the Georgian royal family and in the Armenian Church, who viewed Russian annexation of the Eastern Caucasus as the only way to lift the yoke of Persian rule. Memories were still fresh of Aga Mahmud Khan's Tiflis massacre, and abduction of Christian women and children remained. Yet Persian rule generally had been favourable to the people of the Caucasus, allowing them communal autonomy and lenient taxation. Armenian landowners, Maleks in particular, were content with Persian rule, although their voices were lost to the self-serving enthusiasm of wealthy Armenian merchants abroad and their ecclesiastical allies at home. Similarly, a faction of the Georgian ruling elite viewed decentralized Iranian suzerainty as a blessing, while another faction was lured by the idea of Russian protection. By 1803, Russia claimed sovereignty not only over Georgia, but also over all other Iranian possessions east of the River Kora, provinces coveted for their silk production. In response, the government of Tabriz, under Abbas Mirza, began to exert greater control over the remaining provinces of the Caucasus. But even the Qajar governor of Erevan, who had already anticipated Russian intervention, was not willing to yield. The first round of the Russo-Persian Wars, which began in 1805 with sporadic raids by Iranian irregulars into the interiors of the Caucasus, were aimed to reassert Qajar authority. The Russians ominously retaliated in campaigns organized from Tiflis. For 7 years thereafter, the two parties, Russia and Iran, engaged in campaigns for control of the region north of the River Aras. During the early phases of the war, the Iranians often emerged victorious. By 1807, they had been able to repulse the Russian onslaught, slaying the Russian governor-general of Tiflis in a move much celebrated for its symbolism, and recapturing nearly all the Caucasian provinces except for Georgia. Despite the arrival of Russian reinforcements, in 1810 a Qajar general defending Erevan managed to repel the Russian offensives and capture a substantial number of prisoners of war. The new Russian commander-in-chief was obliged to ask for a peace treaty. Yet the Persian gains remained unconsolidated, and in a matter of just 3 years, the fortunes of war were reversed. In October 1812, the Battle of Aslan Duz, on the banks of the Aras River, some 120 miles north of Ardabil, the Russians, despite their numerical disadvantage, struck a heavy blow to Persian forces. Qajar methods of irregular warfare were incompatible with modern Russian tactics. Reforms of the Qajar army along the European model were too little to have any effect, and then there was the questionable loyalty of local vassals in the Caucasus, some of them of Qajar blood. They were as defiant of Qajar rule as they were resistant to Russian control. By October 1812, Napoleon's disastrous invasion of Russia had reached its final stages, making the victorious Russians, now more confident, capable of striking a heavy blow to their southern nemesis. The Treaty of Golestan, concluded with British mediation in October 1813, granted Russia nearly all of the eastern Caucasus north of the River Aras, and Russia annexed the whole of Georgia and southern Caucasian provinces of Baku, Shirvan, Garabag, Darband, Derbent, and Ganjar. Only Erevan and Nakhchivan remained in Iranian hands. The treaty also gave exclusive rights to Russia to maintain a naval force in the Caspian Sea, in effect exposing northern Iranian provinces to future Russian exploits. By the way of conciliation, the Tsar recognized, albeit ambiguously, Abbas Mirza's claim as the rightful heir to the Qajar throne, while promising at the same time not to interfere in any potential succession disputes over the Persian throne. The Treaty of Golestan was a turning point in modern Iranian history, for it epitomized the gravity of the Russian threat for the remainder of the Qajar era. Golestan, however, was not the final word on the question of the Caucasus. Russia had left several articles of the treaty deliberately ambiguous as a pretext for making further territorial and concessional demands. It took another round of war before the Russo-Persian border was permanently settled along the Aras. War with Russia also brought Qajar Iran to the realization that its northern neighbor was a world power with an advanced army and military capabilities that could repel a massive French invasion on its European front, while checking, and eventually defeating, both the Qajars and the Ottomans on its southern front. What also became evident, almost immediately after the start of the conflict, was Iran's entanglement in European politics. In search of security and potent allies against Russian aggression, the Qajar state intermittently negotiated with both Britain and Napoleonic France. Already in 1801, in the draft treaty negotiated by Malcolm, Iranians had been promised British military and monetary incentives to move against Zaman Shah of Afghanistan, and soon after to preempt a potential Franco-Iranian alliance. In the aftermath of Napoleon's 1797 occupation of Egypt, British authorities were fearful of a potential overland French campaign against colonial India via the Ottoman Empire and Iran. Napoleon's sortie into the Levant though unsuccessful, added to British anxieties. To the British, this was a tangible sign of the French using Iran as a gateway to India. Although such a prospect was highly unrealistic, it made the Qajar Shah and his advisers more conscious of their own strategic position. Playing off the warring British and French, they hoped to muster support for their own objective of containing Russia. British hesitation to ratify the 1801 draft treaty and to honour articles pertaining to monetary support for Iran in the event of foreign aggression disappointed Fath Ali Shah and his advisers. By contrast, he was encouraged by French diplomatic overtures. Early in 1805, an emissary, Amédée Joubert, arrived in Tehran, proposing an alliance with Napoleon. Having already terrified both Russia and Britain on the battlefield, in 1805 Napoleon appeared to the Iranians a brilliant warrior and a natural ally. The French overture was irresistible, even though the Shah had a difficult time accepting Napoleon as the product of a popular revolution that had executed the French monarch. More so, he found it implausible that the French army could ever cross Ottoman territory and overland reach Iran. The May 1807 Franco-Persian Treaty of Finkenstein, nevertheless, was assuring enough for the Shah to give it his seal of approval. The treaty not only promised French support for the return of Georgia to Iran, presumably upon the defeat of Russia in the war with France, but also, and more realistically, offered training and modernization of the Iranian army by French officers and military engineers. With Iran an ally of France, the treaty demanded that Iran expel the British from Iran and declare war on England at a time when Iran was already engaged in war with Russia. Moreover, it obliged Iran to persuade its Afghan subjects in Herat and Kandahar, still considered Iranian vassalages, to attack British possessions in India. In the event that Napoleon started an Indian campaign, a scheme he contemplated when he could not defeat England at sea, Iran would be required to provide overland passage to the French army, as well as to make available its ports along the coast of the Persian Gulf. The French military mission in Iran, under General Charles Mathieu Gardin, an aide-de-camp to Napoleon, began training Qajar forces, building foundries and surveying the land. Under the competent general, the French drill officers and engineers worked with revolutionary zeal. It seemed there might be a chance for the Qajar state to modernize its army and withstand Russian pressure. Soon, however, Gardin was obliged to abort his mission and return to France. In July 1807, 2 months after the Treaty of Finkenstein, Napoleon concluded another peace treaty, this time with the Russian Tsar. The Treaty of Tilsit with Russia, one of the many short-lived alliances concluded by the French Emperor, betrayed Napoleon's erratic war policy. To Fath Ali Shah, however, the treaty was at odds with, if not detrimental to, the French obligations laid out in his own treaty with the French conqueror. Napoleon's fickle opportunism offered the English an excellent chance. Although in 1808 the Shah, still hopeful about the French initiative, had rebuffed Malcolm on his second mission to Iran, in early 1809 he was ready to welcome to his court another envoy of the British crown, Sir Harford Jones Bidges. He was accompanied by the secretary of the mission, James Morier, the future author of the Oriental satire, The Adventures of Haji Baba of Ispahan. Jones, in his earlier career as a merchant of precious stones and English consul in Basra, was aware of the Iranian affairs at a turbulent juncture, when political power was acquired by the Qajars. He even once had dissuaded the desperate Lutf Ali Khan Zand to sell off Nader Shah's jewels, the same jewels that now adorned Fath Ali Shah. As a diplomat, Jones hoped to gain Iranian favour for an anti-French alliance to the tune of £120,000, a backhanded payoff in place of the subsidy that had earlier been promised to Iran but later denied. This was in addition to a large diamond that Jones presented to the Shah on behalf of George III. Negotiations with Abbas Mirza and his team in Tabriz were followed shortly afterward by further negotiations with John Malcolm on his third mission, representing the East India Company. The rivalry between the two envoys, Jones and Malcolm, reflected conflicting British priorities for acquiring Iran's friendship. London's chief objective was Britain's security in Europe through an anti-French coalition, one that must include Russia. For the government of British India, the chief objective was to sustain Iran as a buffer against French threat and against possible Russian expansion toward the Persian Gulf and India. The two objectives finally were reconciled during the 1811 mission under Sir Gore Ouseley, the British Crown's special envoy to Iran, who managed to exert greater influence over the Shah and the court. Abbas Mirza's administration had already welcomed the British officers who accompanied Malcolm from India as partial fulfilment of the earlier British commitment to support Iran. By 1810, they were serving on the Caucasian front along with the Iranians and training soldiers in the art of European warfare. The British government refused, however, to pay the monetary assistance it had promised. Article 4 of the Anglo-Persian Definitive Treaty of Defensive Alliance, renegotiated in 1808 by Jones and finally ratified in November 1814 by Britain, stipulated, "In case of any European nation invading Persia, should the Persian government require the assistance of the English, the Governor-General of India, on the part of the Great Britain, shall comply with the wish of the Persian government by sending from India the force required, with the officers, ammunition, and warlike stores, or in lieu thereof, the English government shall pay an annual subsidy. It is hereby provided that the amount of the said subsidy shall be 200,000 tumans annually. It is further agreed that the said subsidy shall not be paid in case the war with such European nation shall have been produced by the aggression on the part of Persia." The British government rather artfully interpreted Iranian war in the Caucasus as an offensive rather than a defensive measure. Hence, there was little hope that it would support funding Iran with a subsidy or military support. Instead, Ouseley persuaded the Shah and his ministers to accept defeat and enter into peace negotiations with Russia, with himself acting as the mediator and ultimately as peace broker. By 1814, Iran received far less than what it had initially bargained for. Not only had it lost the greater part of its Caucasian provinces, its prestige had been ransomed to conflicting foreign demands. With France defeated and Napoleon in exile, the Shah and the Qajar elite came to the conclusion that if Iran were to survive Russia's onslaught, it had to rely on British support and bravely accommodate that power's whims and wishes. The silver lining for the Qajar state, if there was one, was that Iran served usefully as a buffer between them, even if both Britain and Russia wished to parcel out its valuable pieces. For Qajar statesmen, such as Abbas Mirza and his minister, who were the first line of defence, there was still hope for them to regain what had been so painfully lost. As in Egypt, and shortly after in the Ottoman Empire, Muslim modernizing regimes in the early 19th century eagerly sought to make military reforms, not only to resist European advances, but also, and more urgently, to accelerate the power of the centralized state against the periphery at a time when external defeat incited domestic subversion. The new army, Nizam-e Jadid, literally the new military order, of Azerbaijan, was the first of several attempts to create a modern force capable of waging modern warfare, if not always effectively against foreign enemies, at least against rebels at home. Clad in Western-style uniforms with red jacket, blue pant and long boot, and equipped with fixed bayonet musket, the soldier of the new army, named Sarbaz, literally he who sacrifices himself, was a novelty on the Qajar landscape. The conservative Ulama initially disapproved of the new uniform for being made in the image of the infidels and as a breach of Islamic dress. Yet they were persuaded by the state officials to accept it as necessary for the defence of Muslim lands. In 1838, a firman by the Qajar monarch Muhammad Shah praised the new military uniform, made of Iranian fabric, as the most honourable attire, not only because it was durable, simple, and practical, as compared to the old military uniform, but also because it distinguished the defender of the nation, including the Shah, from the rest of the population, just as soldiers appeared on the carvings of the ancient palace of Persepolis. The new army of Azerbaijan successfully adapted itself to the training and tactics of a modern army. Throughout the late 1810s and early 1820s, it put on an impressive show of discipline and endurance, and the Iranian soldiery was viewed favourably by European observers for its battle hardiness. The new army certainly helped Abbas Mirza remain atop the princely hierarchy, and in later decades it served as a potent agent of the state, eventually facilitating the rise of the reformist premier Mirza Taghi Khan Amir Kabir in 1848.